On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Black satirist and conceptual artist Damali Ayo kicked it off hot a few years ago with her rage-in-cheek website, rentanegro.com. Slavery's been gone for years, she said, but white Americans still need black Americans for answers to racial questions, for politically correct companionship, for cool, and don't know how to get them. It's easy, said the Portland, Oregon satirist, rent them. Now she's been touring the country with her book How to Rent a Negro and raising all sorts of awkward issues about how color lines still trip up Americans today. She's outrageous, she's funny, she's on to something. Up next on Point, How to Rent a Negro with satirist Damali Ayo. Damali Ayo, thanks very much for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.
Here we go. And you make it plain right at the outset. It's not a new joke. You just take it places it had never been before. You give credit to Dick Gregory and black comedian and Godfrey Cambridge, both in the 60s, talking about it. Would you listen with me for just a moment to Godfrey Cambridge's riff on this, if you would? Damali, here we go.
Of course.
Yeah, I can remember years ago when I would go to a party and I'd be the only colored brother there. And they'd all want to talk about the race problem, and I'd want to talk about my golf score. And I'd go to another party, and I'd be the only colored brother there. And they'd all want to talk about the race problem, and I'd want to talk about my Miles Davis records. Till finally they got so bugged, they started inviting two Negroes to the party in case one didn't work out. So now I recognized that there was a crying need to be fulfilled here. So I started my famous Cambridge Rent a Negro play.
Godfrey Cambridge, a great comedian and actor in the 1960s, inspiration for Damali Ayo today. So there, you heard him, Damali. He says years ago this happened to him, and he's talking there in the 60s. Now we're here in 2006, and the joke still works. But why? Does this never end?
I guess not. I mean, not much has changed from when Cambridge was doing that routine. You know, that situation still happens to me and a lot of other people of color out there. You know, like he says, you go to a party, you want to talk about your golf score, but they want to talk about the race problem. You know, for me, I walk into a room and people start talking about racism, partly because of my work, but partly just because of who I am. I mean, that's been going on since I was a little kid.
This is just, it's an outrageous idea then and now. The title, and you see this on a bookshelf, and it's still going to turn heads in a jiffy, and your website did as well. You know, it starts out outrageous, but then I was just laughing into tears with recognition. You know, I mean, you say, you know, you might be a renter. You know, when you think of black people, do you think angry, hostile, too outspoken? Perhaps you need exposure to the kind of black person who can put your mind at ease. You too might be pleasantly surprised at how calm and endearing black people really are. So rent a Negro.
You know, that's funny that phrase calm and endearing came from an email somebody sent me. I had to write them about something, and he wrote me back and said, oh, gosh, I never expected you to be so calm and endearing. And I, you know, we had never even met. So he just assumed I was going to be angry and outraged. So, you know, the other thing that occurs to me when you say, when you see the book on a bookstore shelf, the funny thing is coming on this show, I didn't have my book with me. So I had to go to a couple of stores to get it.
How's it doing?
It's going okay, but, you know, it's shoved away in, you know, African-American section, sociology section. And I wish it was just out there for everybody to just see and pass by because it isn't a special interest book. It's a book about our whole society and the way we live.
Well, you've got sections in here for the renter, that is the non-black person who wants to rent a Negro, and for, what do you call it, the rental, that is the African-American who might need to be, want to be, render, or at least paid for all the kind of interactions that they may find onerous. You know, I think we need to bring some of your stick into this, Damali, to give people a sense of how you work this. If I go to rentanegro.com, or if I crack open How to Rent a Negro, what am I going to learn here?
Well, there's a couple of different sections in the book. One, as you said, is for the rent. And the others for rentals. And basically, you can go through different ways that people interact and say, well, is this me? Is this my life? Is this the way I've treated people or the way I have been treated? And if so, you can either choose to pay people for the rentals you've asked them for, or you can choose to bill people for the professional services you've offered them.
So what kind of interactions should be, in your mind, billable in your conceptual artist satirical world? Maybe more.
Well, you know, there's a wide range. I always kind of liken it to friends of mine who are doctors, lawyers, and mechanics, for example. You know, if I run into my friend who's a mechanic at a cocktail party, I don't just straight up ask her if she can come out and look at my car, or can she help me with a noise, or describe my whole problem to her right there in a social environment.
Mm-hmm.
But for people of color, you know, I have been in many social environments where people walk up to me, and quite often the conversation starts with, I'm so glad that you're here because and so I just brace myself and say, okay, here we go.
My black sister.
Right. And there's never that moment of saying, hey, is it okay for me to ask you a work-related question right now, the way we would do with other professionals in the field, but yet it's still the same kind of, the same nature of question. And it's invasive, and it's, you know, I should have the option to say, I don't feel like working right now, or yes, but here's my fee.
Don't leave me stuck in color. Don't make me the perpetual kind of answer man or woman for issues of color and race and all the rest, please.
Or at least compensate me appropriately. You know, certainly I do have, like you said, 34 years of training at this, you know, which is three times the amount of a friend of mine who's a pediatric oncologist. Talk about a specialty doctor.
Right.
So, you know, so let's recognize what you're actually asking, which is for a professional service and treat it as such.
And what are the fees you're suggesting for which services?
Some of the fees that I talk about are, let's say, provide a black opinion. You know, what is the black community saying about this? That's $75.
Okay.
Touching my hair is $100.
Touching your hair. Are these common things? It sounds ancient.
Everything that's in the book is real. Everything has happened, and everything continues to happen.
Okay.
So I don't deal in fiction. It's never been my nature. So what I've just done is compile the things that are happening on a daily basis and organize them, but I haven't made anything up.
So touching your hair, how much is that these days?
$100 per touch.
Mm-hmm.
Touch my skin is $75. Compare skin tones is $100. You know, the kind of, I just went to the beach and I got so tanned, Damali, I'm darker than you.
Mm-hmm.
Hold out your arm, I'm darker than you.
Mm-hmm.
I hear that a lot. I don't really understand that one because, is there a prize that you're seeking? Like,
hey, check it out. I'm darker than a dark person.
Right. So I feel like saying, have a good time being black, you know, let me know how that works out for you. So I don't know. It's a very odd question.
You say, and it goes right up to $10,000 for a kind of year-long availability in your facetious satirical Rent-A-Negro program. You say you might be a leader in your profession who wants your peers to see that you can relate to everyone regardless of race. These kinds of public rentals can advance your public image and reputation. You'll be surprised how much more interesting you seem to your friends and colleagues when they find out you know a black person. Oh, my gosh. Aren't we past that?
It sounds archaic, doesn't it? No, we're not past it. It happens to me all the time. And one of the questions I get often is, you know, does it vary from geographical place to geographical place? You know, is this just tiny middle America where this is happening? And really, it happens everywhere. So, you know, I don't know how many times I get comments on my dreadlocks, whether I'm walking in Portland or New York City. And sometimes they're complimentary, or sometimes it's questions, or, you know, sometimes I turn around and my hair's in somebody's hand and they're, you know, cooing at how odd and bizarre it is.
I can hear some people saying, wait a minute, these are white people who are trying to be friendly, and here you are, you know, turning around with a snarl and sending them up in a satire that they're just trying to make conversation. You know, chill out, Damali.
I know, it's so hard for white people.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. you know, friendly, you know, in the book, I actually address the difference between a friend and a rental. You know, when you develop a relationship with someone where there's a mutual exchange and sharing, that's fantastic. I'm the first person to advocate that. But when you walk up to someone on the street, for example, a woman walked up to me as I was coming out of my doctor's office, and she asked me, how did I get my hair like that? Mm-hmm. You know? And I thought, I'm sick, you know? And you have no idea. You haven't approached me with any sense of humanity. You've just approached me as if I was you know, the internet or a resource manual. Mm-hmm. And so, and then what's always very telling, when I said to her, because she explained to me that her son wanted to have dreadlocks and she, you know, wanted to find out how to do them. I thought, my first thought was, well, how long have you been standing on a street corner waiting for a person with dreadlocks to walk by?
The burning question on your lips.
My goodness, yes. So I turned to her and I just said, I'm sure he can find out on the internet. And then she got angry with me. And it's that anger that really shows that there's still this expectation for Black people to do as they're told and as they're asked. And that is what is really the underlying problem here.
Serve me. I've got a question. Answer me now, and answer me first and foremost as a Black person. But still, it seems so much like, you know, guess who's coming to dinner? How many decades is that old now? It still seems like something from the mist of time. You say it's not.
Yeah, didn't they just remake that movie, though, just a couple years ago? So, no, it's not all that, or they did a spoof on it or some kind of horrible reproduction, but... no,
maybe it's where we all still live. Maybe it's where we all still park our lives every day. There's a bit Damali Ayo shared with us describing her experience at a bar. It's a little further afield, but you get a sense of the conceptual artist here at work. Here she's having a discussion regarding the real lyrics of the Rolling Stones song Brown Sugar.
So last night, I was out with two women I know at a bar, drinking Bloody Mary's, wine, and munching on fries, doing the usual gossip. I hear the beginning of this song and my eyes light up. Across the table, my friend says, I love this song. Do you know the lyrics, I ask? Yeah, I do, he says, just like a young girl should. No, I say, do you know the lyrics? What do you mean, she says. Wait, I'll show you. I'll sing along. Gold Coast slave ship bound for cotton fields, sold in a market down in New Orleans. Scarred old slaver knows he's doing all right. Hear him whip the women just around midnight. Brown sugar.
Okay, Damali Ayo, so you're not afraid to put it out there with pals. How did they respond when they heard the lyrics as you laid them down there?
Well, they just about wet their pants. You know, I mean, it was shocking. You know, I say later on, you know, my friends are both good feminists. They knew that the song was talking about women in a derogatory way, but they never really paid attention. And that song, it was funny to hear that. That's an old piece I did of conceptual work, you know, just to kind of bring what we hear in our background noise. It's called background music. So bring that into our foreground so that we're actually paying attention. And I think that's a big problem we have in our culture today. We're just not really paying attention. I mean, if we were, we would see the, like you're saying, the repeated examples of objectification, of minstrelsy, of what I'm calling renting, just the way we keep going over and over to the same archaic, you know, way of interacting that should be long dead.
And, you know, and yet I say that with some sympathy because you can still feel people's awkwardness. I mean, I have no doubt a lot of this is not malicious at all. We're just stuck in feedback loops here. Damali Ayo, a lot of listeners want to join us here. Let me begin to invite them in. Jen is calling from Londonderry, New Hampshire. Hi, Jen. You're on the air.
Hi there. I absolutely love your website. A friend of mine in Portland referred me to your website a couple of years ago, and I was like, wow, this really gets it.
That is rentanegro.com.
Yes. I'm a white person, and about 4 or 5 years back through church, I started getting into some anti-racism training as a white person in how to approach the issue of race. And what I found, it's always been a process wrought with conflict because usually this sort of act of renting happens because of the best of intentions on the part of white people. And what ends up happening is that people end up not realizing that they're perpetuating their own privilege by trying to show how much connection they have with people of color and using that as a badge. And because people are white, people who are white can sort of, they have the luxury of not having to pay attention to it.
But isn't there something at least in saying something? In reaching out, isn't there some value in that, just for starters?
No, that's such a common excuse, though.
Well, the thing is, it's about alleviating their own guilt, alleviating white guilt, rather than actually trying to make a connection. It's sort of a perpetuation of the privilege.
Damali, it's an excuse to talk to us about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's this common thing like,
you know, I'm just trying to, like you said, I'm just trying to reach out. I'm just trying to. And then it's as if white people abdicate all of their intelligence in that moment and say, I don't know how to do it. I just don't know how. I'm just going to try any way I can. You know, be thoughtful, for Pete's sakes. It's not that hard, you know. Politeness is such a virtue. So just think about how you would like to be interacted with, for real.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of
yeah.
people say, I would love people to ask me questions about this. And so I turn them around, I start asking questions. Well, how do you wash your hair? I thought white people were very clean. You mean you don't know how to wash your hair? You have to ask me. And then they call me a racist.
Jen, thanks very much for your call. Josh is calling from Boston. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi there. How are you?
We're good. What do you think, Josh?
I have a strong opinion about this this act of renting that you referred to not too long ago.
Yeah.
I have had, you know, people come up to me and ask about whatever uniqueness I happen to have at the point, like where I got my shirt. I had a strange hairstyle that day. And I do not have a problem with this. People are asking me that because of a uniqueness. I just don't think that someone asking you as a black person, they're not asking you about your skin. You know, they're asking you about something that they notice.
Here's the thing. Being black is not unique.
I didn't say
being
it
black,
was, but your hairstyle.
But you're saying a uniqueness. But having dreadlocks is not unique. And that's the problem. People are simply underexposed. And it's not my fault that they're underexposed. It's their fault. So there's so many opportunities to learn about people that doesn't have to be invasive. You know, and if you... And with all respect, you know, having an interesting T-shirt is not the same as growing up in a system that oppresses people of color.
I have also asked a white person about their dreadlocks, and I'm sure that there are people that can call in that are white that have dreadlocks that who have had people coming up and asking.
Josh, let me ask you: do you have any sympathy for what Damali Ayo is pointing to here, or you think it's all just thin skin?
No, I absolutely have sympathy. I understand where it's coming from. I understand that. That is coming from the same right place that your previous caller said. You know, that their intentions are also coming from the best of places. However, I think that there should be some effort to not be as sensitive. Everything isn't about race. And I'm sure there are a whole lot of listeners who just heard that and said, oh, yeah, I've heard that before. Everything is race. It's not. You know, I just don't think that it should be as big a deal as it is.
Yeah, we hear it. Damali?
You know, a lot of white people have such the experience of luxury that in their lives things aren't about race. People of color don't really have that same luxury because in our society so much is about race. And, you know, I have this one conceptual piece I did called The Collar, which is a, you know, fictitious collar that shocks, delivers a shock to white people every time something that is racist or regarding
racial oppression. Like an electric shock collar. Okay, yeah.
Right, like a dog would wear.
Mm-hmm.
And it says the test group of people of color went out in the world and the thing was going off all the time and they found it to be completely accurate and white people came back and complained that said that it was malfunctioning, it was going off all the time, they felt anger and depression and stress and they refused to wear it and threw it on the ground.
Because they weren't being racist when it was giving them a buzz.
I don't think that white people appreciate how much the world revolves around race, how much our society is really obsessed with race. And so when people say it's not about race, I think they aren't really understanding what it's like to live in brown skin.
How do black people, African Americans, respond to your whole send up here? The how to rent a Negro, rentanegro.com. Is it generational, their response? Are they laughing? Are they outraged? Do they think you've gone too far?
Let me just say, for the website, for people who are out there trying to check it out, don't forget the hyphen. So rent-a-negro.com.
Don't forget those hyphens. Okay.
Yeah, or just, you know, search it on a search engine.
Mm-hmm.
There is a wide range of response. There definitely has been some generational, I wouldn't say differences, but I've had some older folks come up to me and ask me what my parents think about the work. A lot of people want to check in with that for some reason. My father kicks up his feet and laughs at it, has a great time. My mom feels a little bit more responsible because, you know, she made a decision to put me in a predominantly white school and stuff like that.
You grew up in Washington, D.C., went to Brown University. Not exactly, you know, a bad row, it would sound.
I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my parents made decisions to put me into the private school system because, you know, listeners from D.C., I'm sure know how terrible the public school system is there.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't an option. And then I worked really hard to continue that education and to fight my way to get into Brown. And absolutely. And I paid for it every day in
both monetary costs and then also just, you know, wear and tear on my emotional state.
Because you were often the sole or one of the very few black people in the room.
Yeah. I mean, I give talks at a lot of schools, and I find that the students there are not only trying to learn everything that they have to learn, but they spend a lot of time educating and teaching. I've been at schools where I've asked the teachers, you know, in a room of 400 kids and, you know, 200 teachers or 100 teachers, how many teachers here have asked a kid of color to explain their culture to the classroom? Mm-hmm. And a lot of teachers' hands go up. And I find that inappropriate. You know, you don't ask a white child to explain, you know, the Civil War. So I think that it's a different road for kids of color and for people of color in this society. And that's the discrepancy that I'd like to point out and see what we can do to start fixing it. Mm.
Damali Ayo says, everybody can use this, rent a Negro. Political groups, no matter what side of the liberal or conservative fence they sprout on, need to show that they attract black participants. This can be a pesky and hard-to-resolve issue, she writes. Renting makes easy work of this common dilemma and allows your group to focus on the issues central to your mission. The satirist at work, Michael's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I want to say, first of all, I find the satire very pointed, very poignant, and I'm laughing.
Okay.
But I think I want recognition to be paid in this day and age about Lenny Bruce doing How to Relax Your Colored Friends at Parties in 1958.
Yeah, I have that. He's amazing.
He did that in front of audiences, not just in New York or Chicago, but in California, which was called by Dizzy Gillespie Mississippi with palm trees at the time.
And what's the routine like, Michael, Damali, can you remember?
I don't know if you can. I'd rather have your guests say it, because if you're going to just, you know, bleep it out. But it was really outrageous prejudice from neo or so-called liberals who wanted to present as maybe a trophy their black friends, mm-hmm. and ask them the most insulting racist stereotype questions. But Lenny did it in a way. He actually did it with his guitar player and one of his best friends, who was black.
Yeah.
As part of a routine, and it pointed up, as did many of the other performance pieces, I guess you would call it. But this is, as I said, started in the 50s when he was doing it.
So way
and
back.
As you know, he went to jail for it.
Yeah.
Lenny Bruce, I'm a huge fan of Lenny Bruce. I mean, we owe such a huge legacy to his changing the face of comedy, his allowing us to talk about our society, our culture, our day-to-day experiences, our friends. He blew it wide open for us. And there's so many routines of his that I just love. I think he had a lot of courage, and we need to continue what he's doing and keep holding up that mirror to each other and saying, what are we doing and how screwed up is it?
Michael in Nashville, thanks for that. You remind us of the lineage here. We talked about Godfrey Cambridge and heard his routine earlier. Dick Gregory picked up on this as well. Your mom brought it to you just a couple of years ago when you were talking with her, kind of got you onto this whole theme. Remind us of that, Damali Ayo.
Yeah, I was really burnt out dealing with a lot of different groups that were inviting me in kind of as the resident black person. When I had different goals. You know, I wanted to talk about networking or supporting my art or how to become involved in different things. And people would really just want, they wouldn't want to talk about that stuff. They would want basically for me to be there to talk about being black or my experience being black or just to hang out and add some local color. And I was talking to my mother about it, and she said, well, Damali, you can't just be everybody's rent-a-Negro. And I thought, maybe I can. I mean, I already am. So it's just a matter of putting the fees in place, and I am set. And so I, you know, basically hung up the phone, and 10 days later I launched the website.
Nonprofit businesses are perfect candidates to become rental clients, Damali Ayo writes. How can you fight child abuse, terrorism, and environmental decay and hire black people? Sometimes even the helpers need a little help. Xander is calling from Boston. Hi, Xander. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say that actually what you've been describing so far is kind of an experience shared by other sort of more recognizable minorities, such as someone like who looks visibly Asian or Hispanic. There are stereotypes associated, like Asians, they're like something to do with martial arts, or like with Hispanics, that they're somehow really good with spices and stuff. I mean, even openly gay people, that they're somehow stereotypically like a good fashion designer. And really, the result of it has been my experience is sort of like multicultural sort of like programs where like a day in public school. I grew up in California. They'll like have people, like they'll pick people who sort of explain themselves and sort of represent their entire race or identity or whatever just by this one person. So it's like you're being asked to sort of be a representative for everything, and you're somehow supposed to conform then to all the sort of cultural stereotypes and everything.
Xander, who were you representing in that game?
Well, actually, I'm mixed. I look more Asian, but I'm actually half Hispanic. So, I mean, basically,
they asked you to do everything.
Yeah, they never really knew what to do to me. So, yeah, it's basically that. It's just the method and style that people are approaching diversity, in that somehow, if you're a certain race, somehow you're automatically going to represent a certain opinion or a certain lifestyle or some sort of experience or something like that.
We hear it, Damali.
Yeah, you know, he's got a really great point, and I feel fortunate that I get emails from people from all different kinds of groups, different racial groups, people with disabilities, deaf folks, saying, hey, this is our experience, too. And so even though I chose to write the book in black-white language, I really was aware that it was a much broader experience, and it's an unfortunate one. I mean, we don't know how to relate to each other as individuals and build a relationship from which we can learn. I mean, I have so many cross-racial friendships that are full of exchange and full of learning, but that's so different than, you know, walking up to someone and asking them if you can put your hands in their hair. You know, can you imagine walking up to a person in a wheelchair and asking them if, you know, you could take their chair for a spin? It's absurd, you know, but there's this experience that different groups have that are so similar, you know, and that sense of being marginalized, that sense of being, like the person said, made to feel unique or somehow so different that people have to invade you to learn about you, when really, you know, all these folks make up our whole society. We're not that different from each other. We are similar, and we're everywhere.
We're talking about racial identity and race interaction, race awkwardness, with conceptual artist and satirist Damali Ayo. She put up the website rentanegro.com. She's written the book How to Rent a Negro. It turns a lot of heads. You hear the satire in it. It's got some real bite. It's not her only project, though. She says when she's got time on her hands, she'll spend time as a conceptual artist on the street panhandling for slavery reparations, talking with passersby. Let's listen.
It's kind of a do-it-yourself approach. You guys want to pay some reparations today? Do you want to pay some reparations?
I'm assuming slavery of some sort.
Do you have anything to explain slavery?
I have to explain slavery?
It's a payment for the work of my great-great-grandfather who was enslaved by people related to you. I'll write your receipt.
Damali Ayo putting it right in the ear and right in the face of the passersby. Paul's calling from Boston. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I do think that you should be sensitive as a non-white or colored person when you approach anyone. Basically, you know, treat everyone, approach everyone like you would like to be approached or treated. But, you know, as a black person, the rent a Negro, I mean, I can kind of see why it's not, but it's kind of being pushed back on bookshelves, because that title is kind of offensive, because as black people, you know, coming out of slavery, you know, we were bought as slaves, and we don't want to be treated as just a piece of property. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's almost like it's kind of defeating the purpose of what you're trying to accomplish with that title. And my last point is, when you were in the lecture hall and someone asked you to give your perspective about the culture of a black person, you know, you can kind of look at it as, you know, the white person doesn't have to tell you about the Civil War and all that, but look at it as an honor, because a lot of white persons are trying to learn about black people, and that's a good thing, because for so many white persons, they refuse to even talk to a black person.
Paul, you know, stick with us here, if you would. Stay with us. Damali, here's a black man saying he's not so sure about this whole thing. You've got a chapter here, Do You Want Fries with That Negro? I think maybe Paul wouldn't go for that. What do you say to him?
Well, I think that Paul made exactly the point that the title makes, which is that, right, we don't want to be treated as objects anymore. I mean, the book is satire, so the title is as archaic as the actions in the book, right? You know, that's exactly what it says. This is stuff of a time that should be past. As far as the idea that it's an honor to be asked by a white person, you know, to explain black history or black culture or blackness in general. That's what the library is for. You know, I think it's so ironic that there's the stereotype that black people are lazy when I experience so much white laziness on a regular basis that when I'm curious about something, you know, I don't even have to get out of bed. I don't even have to get out of my pajamas. All I have to do is click on Google and I can find as much information as I want. But yeah, yet there's this waiting and this expectation to teach.
Paul, what do you say?
I agree with that, you know, with the internet age and all that. But, you know, it's nothing like to be talking to a real person and finding out, you know, how did they grow up? You know, how was your life? Where did you live? And, you know, how did it feel growing up in this type of a neighborhood? I mean, you just can't get that on the internet.
But there's so many books written about that.
But is Damali Ayo too thin-skinned, too sensitive here then, Paul, from your perspective?
Yeah, I do. I think so. I mean, I totally agree with the part. You should do research, but where is face-to-face communication? Are we so removed from talking to one another? And
You're black. Have you never felt this kind of trapped in the color, weariness that Damali describes?
When persons ask me questions, yeah, sometimes I'm thinking, yeah, you know, this person is so naive and, you know, where have they been? And I feel that way. But at the same time, I look at it as an opportunity to explain things to them. And you know what? I actually get a lot of positive feedback from them in return. And
I'm sure you do.
And develop a great relationship with the person that if I would have just said, yeah, go check the internet, bye, get out of my face, I would never forge some good relationships that should have been forged.
Yeah,
well,
Damali,
you.
Are you the jaundiced one here then?
Are you calling me yellow skin
well,
now?
Well, okay. You know what I'm saying.
No. You know, here's what I think. When I know I'm going to have an interaction with somebody or I'm curious about a community or a subject or whatever it is, everybody should do, there's no harm in doing background research so that when you have that face-to-face interaction, you don't come off as naive. I mean, it's as embarrassing to white people as it is frustrating to people of color.
Yeah.
So why not raise yourself to a level where you can have an intelligent conversation with somebody and actually grow and actually respect them in the process instead of what happens too often, which is, you know, to be demeaning and demanding.
Please, 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 says Damali Ayo. Tim's calling from Stillwater, Oklahoma. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Yeah, I agree with the previous caller. I'm from the white experience. I think in America we tend to be bombarded with images of black people through the media. But for many, many white people, it's kind of rare to have that opportunity to interact with a black person face-to-face. And I think that's where some of this awkwardness might come from.
So when Damali says, you want me, rent me, how do you feel?
I don't think I'd go as far as renting.
I mean,
but
I mean, why not? I mean, if you're going to ask for a professional service, why not be the professional enough and respectful enough to compensate for that?
Well, I think your example earlier about being at a party and not wanting to talk about yourself or what you do, I'm going to start charging people for questions about birds because I'm a bird watcher, you know, and I always get that at a party. I got this bird, you know, and it's tiresome, but again, it's an opportunity to share some knowledge. So I take it and do it gladly.
I mean, it seems to me the hard thing here is that there can be good intentions on all sides. Damali, you're standing up for kind of dignity, and don't just tread on me with, you know, two easy questions again and again. But then here's Tim saying, look, I don't get a chance to talk with black people very often, and I want to take advantage of it when I do.
But at the same time, I mean, there's a lot of levels going on here. First of all, Tim doesn't have to disclose that he's a bird watcher. I don't have a choice in that. I'm a visible minority.
Yeah,
so my whole life, since I was a child, I've been answering these questions. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm experiencing is that when I was 8 years old, I was answering certain questions to other 8-year-old kids about race, about my hair, about Kwanzaa, whatever it was.
Sure.
And why am I now at 34 having those same 8-year-old conversation with 40-year-olds, with 50-year-olds?
Mm-hmm.
This is my concern for our society. If we allowed our members of our society to be at an 8-year-old level with regard to nutrition, math, English, we would consider we have a national crisis on our hands. But right now, we allow that level with regards to racial understanding, and it's fine.
So let's keep on growing up. And we hear that call. Tim, in Stillwater, thanks for your call. Brian's calling from New York City. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
So I'm a white American, and I've never really had too many problems relating to people of color. But I think that, some of the most difficult conversations I have are with people, with fellow white people who for their whole lives have been unaware of their selves as a person, you know, a person with a race. And I really respect this project. It sounds very interesting, but I also wanted to hear, you know, what your guest had to say about relating to other white people and how that conversation can become easier.
That's a great question. I mean, I think that the work, I get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but I do think that ending racism is white people's work. You know, there's only so much, I always make this comparison because it's a lot easier. Women are always told that men are stronger than us. So why don't men use that strength to lift the glass ceiling? It's the same thing. Black people and people of color are constantly told that white people are very smart, often smarter than we are. So I would love to see that actually, you know, that intelligence be proven by seeing white people come together to dismantle systems such as racism, systems such as, you know, just cultural insensitivity. And I think that white people are so capable. You know, people think that I have a grudge against white people, but I don't. I believe in white people. And I think that if they come together, they could say, hey, we got this problem that maybe our great-great-grandfathers created. It's called racism. I bet we could figure out how to get rid of it. Let's start on that.
Wow. Karen's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to know if I could get permission to start the subsidiary rentawoman.com.
I think that's already out there, Karen.
Yeah, do it up. Just, yeah, watch the legalities of that one.
What do you mean? What are you saying, Karen?
I had an experience where it was so similar that I just laughed out loud when I heard the beginning of the program, but it was about my job as a woman, which is to make you feel warm and happy in every circumstance. And I was in a environment where people were doing workouts and stuff, and it was a fairly tough situation, and it was a male instructor, and he came over to me and said, and he went to other women in the class and said, where's my smile? Where's my smile? And I said, I don't owe you a bleeping smile. I'm here working as hard as I can. And he was so offended. He was so hurt.
So put a price on it, Karen, if you were going to rent it. How much for a smile?
You know, I'll have to consult Damari about that.
$50 maybe?
I need
write up
help.
An invoice.
Well, you know, it's in a more serious level, we do rent women. We rent women as waitresses. Every woman who has ever worked in a service environment knows that if you smile, if you show a little cleavage, if you, God help you, let them touch you on the butt or whatever, you know you're going to make an extra 20. And it's so degrading. It just gets you right in the core after a while. And eventually what it does is make you just look at guys as just another number, just another chump.
Or maybe a customer. There's a little cross-color line harmony going on here. Karen, thanks very much for your call. Damali, our time is short. What's your 12-step program or 3-step program? I mean, what's your advice to work out of this corner?
Well, it's funny because I actually did write something called the 12 White Steps, which is you know, a starting recovery program for white people to help end racism.
Yeah.
And you can find that on my website, damaliio.com, actually.
Okay.
I think, well, first of all, you know, this has been a bit of a serious conversation, and I think it's important to remember that the book really does take a humorous approach to this.
Oh, it's funny front to back. It's all a send-up.
Oh, thanks. And you know, white people have said to me that they read the book and they laughed the whole way, and then they laughed the whole way, but they also had a pit in their stomach. And so there's that dual push-pull that is present in all my work. I want to invite you in, but I want you to really see what happens when you get there, hold you accountable. So I would say to go out in the world, really see how race is handled, really open your eyes, kind of like that brown sugar piece says, are we listening? I would, a really small task that I ask people to do is, if you look at our language, you see that we say, I saw a man walking down the street. And then we will say, I saw a black man walking down the street. Now, the first man is white, but we don't say that because white is the default race. So just try to either remove the descriptor of race from people of color, right, all the time, or insert it and see how often you notice white people in your environment. Like somebody said earlier,
white people struggling with the idea of having a race, start seeing white people, start say, I saw a white man walking down the street, and see how that changes your experience as a white person.
And pretty soon the head is turned. Damali Aiyu, you got all our attention. You got some laughs from us as well. We're grateful for your time and for your work here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.